You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ask anyone who lived in New York's Lower East Side during the 80s and early 90s, and they will tell you it was an open-air drug market with drug crews hawking their wares on street corners and keeping an eye out for the cops. During that turbulent time, retired NYPD Detective Michael Cadella worked Alphabet City, or Alphaville, as he calls it in his new memoir, from 14th Street South to Houston Street and from Avenue A East to Avenue D. And Avenue D was the place where he focused on nabbing the head of the Lower East Side's heroin supply chain. Alphaville, 1988, Crime, Punishment, and the Battle for New York City's Lower East Side brings Cadella and co-author Bruce Bennett to our studios. Welcome to WNYC, Michael.
Thank you.
And Bruce.
Hi.
I want to set this up, Michael, as you do with a reading from your opening chapter about cruising the neighborhood in your unmarked patrol car with your partner Gio up Avenue D. Set it up for us as a plainclothes housing authority cop in Operation 8, assigned to deal with a drug trade in public housing in Alphaville. What were these patrols for?
Just patrol of the projects, you know, and the.
So you were basically going around the block, around the projects, looking for.
Yeah, looking for drug dealers and trying to prevent, you know, drug deals and crimes in general.
Okay, so would you mind reading that that paragraph
sure.
there?
The heat and the wet air smear sounds, smells, shapes, and colors. An anonymous Clavero goes to town on a salsa track, sputtering from a passing car stereo. For a moment, the beat accompanies a steerer hawking bags of Mr. T, Mr. T, for a corner smack dealer. His chants turn to 5-0, 5-0, yo, Rambo on the block, as he catches sight of our car and my face. The salsa track briefly jams and the crackle on our dash police radio, then a snatch of distorted thudding dance music from somewhere else and the shrieking seagull come inland from the harbor to trash pick the dumpsters behind the projects. The mix of sweat and cologne my partner and I generate are no match for the sour garbage, stink, garlic, cigarette smoke, sweet-scented disinfectant Hispanic soup is used in their building hallways, and rotten egg East River tidal funk wafting in the windows and the sounds.
I love it. It really captures that sort of hot, sweaty summer day in a very crowded, chaotic Lower East Side neighborhood. Bruce Bennett, you lived in the Lower East Side during the time of Michael's memoir. Typical of a scene in the hood, that sort of open, very public drug dealing.
Yeah, it was typical in my experience, and it's the surprising thing. A, was that it was happening, and B, how quickly you got used to it. And it's, you know, it was interesting, sort of, you know, working with Mike on the book and like kind of exploring just how much. You know, the gravity of that business, like how much that I kind of took for granted, you know, being younger and not, you know, being in law enforcement or a drug addict for that matter, just kind of sidestepping it as much as possible, but working with Mike and discovering like, you know, just how much it affected, like how much it just sort of bent so much of what happened in the neighborhood around that commerce, you know, around mm-hmm. that, the, you know, those crimes.
And Mike, you set that hot, sweaty summer day scene, and you're on patrol, and that turns out to be a very eventful day. Describe what else happened during that. What happened later? That opening scene that you describe in your book.
Later that day, there's actually an assault that takes place between guys that had at one point been friends and are no longer friends. And one guy actually hits his ex-friend in the back of the head with a baseball bat. And the result is the guy loses his eye.
Mm. Yeah, a very graphic scene. You see this guy walking down the street with a baseball bat. You sense trouble, turn the car around, and by the time you get to the scene, he's already beating up two of these guys with a baseball bat. Typical of the neighborhood at the time, a lot of violence right there, middle
yeah.
of the day.
Sure, a lot of violence, a lot of tempers, a lot of, you know, people looking to score dope, and when they can't, they either get aggravated or agitated. People looking to get money to help score some dope, so there was always something brewing in the projects.
You grew up in Canarsie, and you described the neighborhood as being half NYPD, half mob. I love your comparison to that Looney Tunes cartoon of Sam the sheepdog and Ralph the wolf wishing each other good morning before they punch in at a time clock on a tree and start battling each other over sheep. Tell me more about that. Were you aware of that as a kid? Was this only knowledge gained later in life?
It was pretty. It was pretty common knowledge, actually. You know, we knew there was not much hiding what people did for a living, and we knew Canarsie was kind of a small knit community. So you either knew the guy that was up to no good, or you knew his kids, and everyone knew basically what everybody was doing or was up to.
And did that influence who you were allowed to play with? Your father was a housing cop. Did he say, don't play with Benny?
No.
Did you ever have any sort of rules like that?
No. Actually, there wasn't really much rules like that. The kids, we kind of did our own thing, basically.
When did you learn that your grandfather, with whom you were very close, Giovanni, used to run numbers and booze for Lucky Luciano?
Oh, yeah, that was sometime when I was older, not really as a kid.
Describe how you learned about that.
Little by little, my mother would bring things up, and my uncle, who's since passed, told me some stories. And little by little, I kind of got initiated into my grandfather's past. And they weren't ashamed of it. Actually, they were kind of proud that he got away from that and, you know, lived a clean life, so to speak, afterwards.
Do you think that's what influenced your dad to be a housing cop? He sort of made the choice. He got into city work through the sanitation department and then just decided to take the test to become a cop. What prompted that?
Well, my grandfather, who was a connected guy, isn't his father. That was my mom's dad.
Uh-huh.
Right. And my father, I think he just felt that the police department was more his style instead of the sanitation. That's helped him to provide for the family better.
So really just a very practical decision on his part. Bruce Bennett, you're a native New Yorker too, born in Manhattan, is that right?
Yeah, Lenox Hill Hospital.
Did you have a similar upbringing, running wild with some of the scenes that he describes Michael describes of running with his friends and rolling pimps in Times Square in the 70s?
No, I ran mostly through the mean streets of McLean, Virginia. My parents were suburb bound when I was born. So I think I did a year in Manhattan, and then
You did your time.
Yeah, I did. I was strolled through the mean streets of, I think, Gramercy Park, actually. And then we cleared out for the burbs, and then I came back in 81. So I mean, I could definitely relate to Mike's family's roots in the city, because my family also had roots in the city, but they're very different roots and, you know, coming from a very different direction.
How did that help or hurt your understanding of what Michael went through as a kid and then the shaping of the book?
I did have wild years. They were nowhere near as wild as his. And I think, you know, honestly, I think the thing that made, to the degree that the book is a success, you know, that it works, that our collaboration worked in making it so, it's that we're basically exactly the same age. And so we're both at a point in our lives where kind of like, you know, you get a certain, hopefully, theoretically, you get a certain distance and a certain, you know, engagement about your own past and certain distance and engagement about the pasts of your parents. You know, in a lot of these, like, sort of these kind of balkanized, you know, notions of like what, you know, what our family really did in the war, et cetera, those things, like, you know, you finally ferret things out. You go to that funeral where somebody says, well, actually, that's not what, you know, your dad always said that, but what he meant was, you know, or where he really was. And so, you know, I think we just kind of related on that level, you know. We both, you know, everybody comes from an interesting family in the best and worst ways. And, you know, we both, you know, it was easy to talk about.
I'm speaking with Bruce Bennett and Michael Codella, co-authors of Alphaville, 1988, Crime, Punishment, and the Battle for New York City's Lower East Side. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books. I'm Amy Eddings here on the Leonard Lopate Show, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. Michael, you write that you have a bone-deep craving for thrills and excitement, that you get a huge kick when things were close to out of hand, the wild zone between safe and sorry. And again, as I mentioned earlier, you ran with kids who felt and acted the same way. You used to roll pimps in the bad old Times Square before it was Disneyfied. What made you land on the side of cop versus robber?
I think I just smartened up, you know. I kind of saw where some of my friends and acquaintances and just people from the neighborhood ended up. And
where did they end up? Were a lot of them jailed?
A few of them were jailed. A few of them got killed. And I realized that it's going to either end up that way, jail or death. And neither one suited me. Mm. So,
were you ever drawn to the drug trade yourself? Did that ever look attractive to you?
No. I never. I was never interested in that. I hadn't even seen hard drugs until I became a cop, actually. I mean, I knew they were out there. I knew some of my friends fooled around with it, but I had never even seen it. I took myself out of that situation whenever it arose.
Bruce, how did you collaborate with Michael on his story? How did you work out that partnership? What did that look like?
It was a lot of phone calls. It was a lot of taping, and it was a lot of back and forth with, you know, I'd come up with stuff. Mike had material he generated originally for a first attempt at it. It primarily, I think, wound up being kind of a journalistic experience. You know, we were both, you know, I'd do research, we'd talk, I'd write things down, I'd give them to Mike to read, he'd go, no, yes, you know. Mm. Or, I mean, the interesting thing about working with him, working with you, was that if you didn't hit the exact direct question, you wouldn't really find out, because I think you're so accustomed to just being kind of like, you know, like
just the facts.
Cut and dry, just the facts, exactly, you know. And it's like, you know, everybody has a nuanced life, and I think, you know, it just was like – it was a matter of just like sort of keeping on it and keeping it sort of, you know, between the goalposts of being sort of entertaining and being true at the same time. So
one of the threads and the nuances that I really liked about it was the description of the way of the mob tentacles that eventually wrapped around your grandfather, Michael, and how the mob got into the heroin trade that you eventually battle as an adult. Bruce, was that part of what you helped add to the story, this thread, this research on the mob?
Yeah. I mean, it was something that Mike was genuinely interested in and had, you know, had firsthand knowledge, but also had read up on. I mean, we're both big fans of Selwyn Robb's Five Families, and we both had sort of a, you know, kind of conversational understanding of these things, but he had a real passion for it. I mean, honestly, I feel like it's an outgrowth of, you know, him being a cop and me being, you know, essentially like a bike messenger, you know, kicking around in the Lower East Side in the 80s. There are certain vocations or certain attitudes that you can have in the city that allow you to kind of see through the layers a little more than you would otherwise. And so it was always a matter of kind of just trying to entertain what the layers are, you know, mm-hmm. like what building was here before, like what, you know, where, you know, follow the money, all of that kind of stuff. Like, you know, because I think New York is just, it gives you a really concentrated opportunity to see those layers or ignore them for that matter.
Michael, you started as a cop for the Housing Authority patrolling public housing projects in Coney Island. How did that experience help you when you became a detective working the drug beat in Alphaville?
You know what? Coney Island wasn't really the busiest place in the world. But if you're looking for an arrest or if you're looking to lock somebody up or make a call, it's out there. So
So you had to be enterprising.
You had to be enterprising. You had to go hunting, you know, looking if you really wanted to get an arrest. And then the Lower East Side, the drugs were there. You didn't need to really hunt. So with the knowledge of how to look for stuff and going to the Lower East Side and seeing it almost right in front of you, it kind of helped you a little bit.
Your level of detail is incredible. And you talk about that early on, about how as a cop you were trained to really look people in the eye and size them up pretty quickly, who was there to score, who was there to sell. Do you feel this helped you in terms of writing your memoir? I take it you have a very good memory for all these details are very vivid in the book and must be very vivid in your memory.
He has a sick memory.
Especially when related to the job, I have a good memory.
So you remember every case?
I remember most of the case. I remember everyone's name. I remember where we arrested them, the address they live. And as far as the knowing what somebody's up to, I mean, that comes from both being a cop and being a kid or a teen that was up to no good also, because I kind of remember how I behaved and my friends behaved when we were up to no good. And I would just see it reflected back to me and the guys on Avenue D or wherever I was working.
Takes a player to know a player.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Michael Cadella and Bruce Bennett. Alphaville, 1988, Crime, Punishment, and the Battle for New York City's Lower East Side is Michael's memoir about his time as a cop in the late 80s in Alphabet City. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate today. Michael, the book is about your attempt to go after the drug kingpin of the Lower East Side, a guy named Davey Blue Eyes. Tell me about him.
Well, Davey was someone that had an amazing presence on the Lower East Side, whether you saw him or not. He just kind of controlled everything, and everyone knew him, everyone knew of him. And it took us a long time to figure out exactly who he was. And when we finally did, we realized that he actually pulled the strings for the heroin trade. I mean, there were other guys out there that made a lot of money, but ultimately the money in some form went back to him.
Why is it that this neighborhood was like the national hub, you call it, of the retail heroin trade? Why this particular neighborhood, do you think? Bruce, you want to try that on for size?
Easy access. I mean, it's nobody cared about the projects past a certain point. So it things could pretty much run riot within the projects.
But why the projects there and not anywhere else?
Because you have the FDR, you have Houston Street, you have the bridges beyond. It's very easy to get into and very easy to get out of. I mean, that's my belief. Does that seem fair?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think that early on, when heroin became the drug for the poorer people, I think they must have had some heavy hitters that made that their home, and that was it, and that just became that way.
To also the physical proximity to Chinatown, because there's a lot of, in the 80s specifically, a lot of heroin started coming in from China, and a lot of the sort of criminal organizations that were based in Chinatown started taking more of an interest in the heroin trade, and so there wound up being sort of a collaboration there. And again, it was location, location, location.
You retired in 2003, Michael, from the NYPD. Certainly the Lower East Side is a shadow of its former self, very gentrified. Are there still problems specifically, though, in the projects there?
There'll always be a dope problem. I mean, the bottom line is it's not what it was, of course. And I think other parts of the city have a bigger dope problem in specific areas. But, I mean, there'll always be some heroin, some coke in a low Alphabet City projects.
One thing I was struck by is you're working your sources, right? Going around and talking to people who were users or who were low-level dealers. And I'm surprised today with the sort of the people actively wearing no snitch T-shirts, mm-hmm. That anybody would even talk to you back then. what was that about?
You know, me and my partner worked there for so many years. We actually became like someone from the neighborhood. It was almost when they spoke to us, they were doing a few things. Number one, they were trying to ingratiate themselves with us, protect themselves so we wouldn't go after them, eliminate their competition. And they related to us on a different level than they related to most cops because they saw us there day and night in the cold and in the heat. So that became a big part of it.
Jeremy left this comment on our show page. In 1980, I moved to 7th Street between C and D, which was a pretty good block. Mm-hmm. But the block between B and C was substantially abandoned and the empty buildings were taken over by drug dealers. That was obvious to my naive self and to everyone in the neighborhood. If the cops had wanted to make arrests, they could have walked up to the dealers and put cuffs on them. But cops had no interest in arrests until the first gentrification wave in the mid-80s. Until then, they had no interest in cleaning up the neighborhood. Was someone paying them off? And why did the city abandon the poor people of the East Village to the predations of drug dealers?
We actually go into the... You want to speak about that?
We go into a lot of detail about precisely that in the book. A lot of it has to do with the sort of procedural hangover from the Knapp Commission hearings. And the NYPD decided, to me, it's like sort of administratively parochial decision. They needed to set out guidelines for patrol for what we call city cops and what were called city cops in the book when the police forces were separate. They needed to have control guidelines that prevented uniformed cops from making direct drug arrests because they basically didn't trust the rank and file in the wake of the Knapp Commission hearings to do the right thing, which is that's not how you fight crime
mistrusting your own officers, your own force.
Officer, feel free to observe drug activity and report to your superiors about it was essentially it. And that's not how you bring down a heroin ring is the way that Mike and his partner did, which is by just punching away at it until who's the guy? Where is the guy? Is it you? Okay, if it's not you, we're throwing you in jail until you tell us who it is.
But it was also it was also a policy, was it not, to go to avoid going after the low-level guys. There was this idea that you wanted to kill the snake at the head. But that changed with the broken windows theory later on in the 90s, correct?
Well, yeah, that's what exactly what Bruce was meant. Basically, the NYPD Uniform Patrol was not allowed to arrest drug dealers.
It must have been very frustrating for you.
Not for me, because I was a housing cop.
Yeah, didn't make any difference.
For me, I didn't. You know, we locked up whoever we wanted to, dealing drugs or whether we saw it or not, basically.
And yet, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, if we knew they were dealing drugs, chances are we'd catch them. One way or the other.
And yet, the opening segment that you read from, these guys were clearly hawking drugs, but you didn't go after them. You were, in fact, looking to work them as sources and see if they could tell you more about Davy Blue Eyes. Did you turn a blind eye to the dealing that they were doing because you were so busy just trying to get to the top man?
No. If in fact, guys did try to sell in front of us, we'd probably lock them up. For some reason, if we didn't, that means that we probably gave them the okay for the day to do what they wanted. But they still wouldn't do it in front of us because that would actually be disrespectful, and they wouldn't do that. But if we didn't lock up a drug dealer on a corner, that was the guy who probably gave us information that day.
Anna on Facebook writes, I live on 11th between B and C, and the bodies used to lay there for almost 24 hours. I used to wonder if the police did it on purpose to make a point.
If they let the bodies
lie there on purpose to make a point. I don't know what point that – I'm certainly the drug dealers would like those bodies to lie there for a while to make a point. Like, don't mess with me. But do you remember this, or you recall this, like a lag time in the
it was so
EMTs coming to collect the dead?
You know, it was just so busy down there. if they were laying there for a little while, it must have been they were probably picking up a dead body around the corner.
Wow.
And, you know, the city was really struggling financially then, too. I mean, I don't know in this specific instance, but my guess from my experience down there, that's probably more like somebody made a call and it was ignored and ignored and ignored. I mean, there really was your one commentator on the web, pointing out that there was just no kind of on a municipal level, there was no interest whatsoever in that neighborhood until all of a sudden it was, it became this fascinating idea that, like, you could develop there. And I think that's absolutely true. It was totally my experience. But with the police, I think it was a little more complicated. I think people tend to assume that Operation Pressure Point was entirely a result of somehow like ordained by real estate speculators and stuff like that. But it just was like there's a really complicated and self-defeating series of sort of checks and balances and valves and stuff administratively in the mayor's office and in, with the NYPD and also with, federal crime-fighting organizations, as far as how it was that they were going to deal with New York generally and with the heroin trade specifically, And they're really just – it's like dawning understanding of different ethnicities entering into that and, like, a lot of stuff that just, like – it meant that there was a fair amount of tail chasing on any given day, Mm-hmm. I don't really subscribe to the idea that it was like this nefarious, idea of, the collusion between real estate interests and the mayor's office, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that's actually true, but it may feel that way.
Michael Cadella, you say you were not picky about bending the rules as a cop. What do you mean by that?
Well,
give me some examples.
Well, let's say just the fact that we would talk to drug dealers and take information from them and let them maybe work a little bit, let them deal.
Turn a blind eye.
Kind of turn a blind eye. Uh-huh. It obviously would be a big, no-no. Just even using informants and paying them cash out of our own pockets is definitely not approved, not authorized by the NYPD or any police in New York.
You also mention with your caller of this guy with the baseball bat, he had some dope on him, and you went through this mental checklist in your head of do you turn it in to evidence,
right,
or do you hold on to it and use it to
right.
help ply information from – from
right.
addicts.
I mean, we had informants that would get sick, like any drug user, and to kind of keep them from getting sick, we'd give them dope, and they'd be in debt to us, So.
Do you consider yourself a good cop?
Yes.
And what does that mean?
Well, number one, I never did anything to benefit myself as far as taking money or taking drugs or benefit anyone, basically. Everything I did with the big picture of locking up the bad guys.
And you didn't eventually get Davy Blue Eyes, but someone else did.
Well, you know what? Someone else got them, but...
You set it up.
I feel like it
was your caller.
Yeah. I mean, they may see it another way or remember it a different way, but the way I remember it is it was my phone call that actually put them away.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
The writing in the book is really dynamic and visual. Have you been approached about a film adaptation?
We're actually shopping it around as we speak, yeah.
It actually was optioned at the proposal stage, much to my surprise, but that didn't, you know, it's one of those things that just sort of mechanically seems to happen, you know, within agencies. But we actually have some interesting guys that we've been talking to, and it's thank you, by the way. I mean, you know, honestly, the dynamicness of the writing, that's even a word, it's entirely a reflection of how dynamic and wonderful that neighborhood was. And even with all of that, you know, dreadful stuff going on, it just was the most amazing place to be. It's the most amazing place to live, and it was the most amazing place to work, you know.
Well, and I'll wrap up with this. People get nostalgic for that time and for a Times Square where you could roll a pimp for several hundred dollars.
Easy money.
Michael, as somebody on in the mix, right, not an observer in the way that Bruce
right.
Bennett was, misplaced nostalgia? Or do you sort of miss it?
No, I sort of miss it.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, it was New York. New York in the 80s and 70s. It was there was no place like it.
And Bruce, you live in Brooklyn now. You left the Lower East Side 2004. Did you run screaming because of the coffee shops and
I was bought
tea
out
salons?
By my landlord.
Okay.
I lived on Ludlow between Stanton and Rivington, which is it was overrun. It was like living in, you know, at Bourbon Street. The thing I think that it's very easy to be nostalgic about the Lower East Side in the 80s because it was a genuinely fun place, but I think it's also human nature to be nostalgic about who you were in your 20s and realizing, I think Mike and I both share this, that we're still here, you know, after all of that, you know, like after all those adventures, all of that stuff, you know, like you're still here. So it's very easy to be nostalgic about the place where that took place, you know.
Bruce Bennett, Michael Codella, co-authors of Alphaville, 1988, Crime, Punishment, and the Battle for New York City's Lower East Side, Michael Codella's memoir of being a detective helping to bring down the drug trade on the Lower East Side in the 1980s. Thank you so much for joining us. Great book.
Thank you very much.
This is WNYC.